Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
And welcome back. We're so glad you're here with us. We've got a fantastic episode today. We love listener letters episodes. But first, have you ever wondered if there were a way to capitalize on all that online chatter of the millions of investors on social media? Well, your wait's over because the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds, that's now at your fingertips. It's called the Buzz Index. And what it does is looks at all of those different social media platforms, aggregates the results, and has created the best of the best, the most talked about in the most positive way, pieces on the internet. So invest in the wisdom of the crowd. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. We'll share more a little bit later in the show. But for now, Miranda Marquette.
Hey, welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. We are answering your listener questions, and we've got a crack team to take care of it today. First of all, hi, Linda. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Miranda. How are you?
I am doing all right. Linda is from Be Wealthy and Smart, and she is here to help us be both wealthy and smart. Mm-hmm. And we've also got Joe. We've got Joe. Yeah. How are you doing today, Joe?
If you don't want to be so wealthy or so smart.
Back Benjamins.
Right. Yeah. I'm good. It's cold. It is 7 degrees in Northeast Texas, which happens about once every 4 or 5 years. So it's an exciting day to be here with the space heater on.
Yeah, you guys ended up with colder weather and even a little bit of snow. And our snow is almost melted up here in Idaho. I mean, we're expecting more, but for now.
I love how, though, I post a picture on social media of our snow. And I said, I love both days it snows here in Texarkana, which is true. And my Canadian friends are all like, oh, you call that snow? I thought that was like a dusting.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right.
Pretty much. Well, let's get into the listener mailbox. Let's see what we've got here and see if we can answer a few questions. It's always interesting to me that people want to know what we think about this sort of thing. But we'll go ahead and do our best. So our first question today comes from Jim. And Jim says, greetings, fantastic team. Greetings to you, Jim. Thank you for calling us fantastic. He is an entrepreneur. He is looking to hire a CFP to help build a high-level financial plan for himself. His goal is to hire someone to act as a financial coach or mentor plus personal CFO. He's not finding the skill set in the local market and was wondering if any of us have any recommendations for him. So let's start with you, Jim. If you were looking for somebody to kind of be your mentor, to kind of help you, you know, financial coach your way through this, where would you turn? Like, where are some places that Jim can go to find the help and advice he wants?
Who the heck's Jim?
Oh, well, Jim is our guy, and I totally meant to turn it to you, Joe. Joe, let's have some advice for Jim.
Well, Debbie, let me explain it this way.
I hate you so much.
Who's on first?
Right. The number one place to look is I would go to people who are people just ahead of you, not just in age, but people who are doing what you want to do, who are in the position that you want to be in after you hire the financial coach, and see who their coach is. Because for those people are going to be the people that hire the fantastic advisors. I found that looking locally is always a minefield if you look to the wrong people for advice. So I would go to smart people, say, hey, who's your financial advisor and how do you like them and how do you work with them, and start there. That's not the place to end, by the way. Once you do that, then you go to BrokerCheck, FINRA, the Financial Regulatory Authority. They have a spot on their website called BrokerCheck, and you want to go check the person's record. You might want to make sure they're a certified financial planner. You want to ask about how they charge and really what they cover, because some advisors only cover investing. And if you're really looking for somebody to be a financial coach and mentor, you might not want somebody that just deals with the stock market all day. You might want somebody with a more holistic approach. But regardless of what you're looking for, you want to have a meeting where you thoroughly find out about them, their expertise, who they work with, and if it lines up with the type of thing that you're looking for.
Yeah, I really like that point. And I especially like that idea of going and figuring out from, you know, where you want to be and finding out who they use. That's a really good place to start. What about you, Linda? Do you have any thoughts on this?
I would check with the College for Financial Planning with their roster and see who the CFPs are around you, because it is good to find someone locally. It's nice to meet in person, I think, and have that personal touch. If not, then I think you can probably search the web for some CFPs that might be a personal CFO, that kind of thing. But I would really just get clear on what you really want, because this sounds very general, like you have an idea. But Jim, get really specific about what are the qualities you're looking for. What do you want the person to do for you? You want a high-level financial plan, you said. What kind of coaching, mentoring are you really looking for? And is that what you really need, or is it something else that perhaps you need?
Yeah, that's also a really good point. See, it's so great to have you both on the show. So let's move on to the next question. This one is a little bit longer. This is from Miles, and he says, good evening. I recently came across this podcast after deciding I wanted to be a more knowledgeable money manager and investor. Oh boy, have you come to the wrong place. so anyway, he says he's trying to figure stuff out, and he's trying to figure out if he's maximizing his money the best way. He's 22 years old. He's a recent college grad. He's got a 401k from a previous employer. And he's got another 401k that he is contributing to right now. So he's great at savings. He's opened a Roth IRA, an interest-bearing savings account, two of them. He's got two interest-bearing savings accounts, and he has his money in a robo-advisor. He's got it with Wealthfront, and he has also got a checking account with Aspiration, which is a kind of cool new bank and idea. So monthly, he sits down and allocates a certain amount of money of my income that he divides up into each of these accounts. He has no true knowledge about stocks or how they work, so he's chosen this route as a way to kind of put himself in a familiar situation, letting the money grow based off of interest-bearing accounts. But I'm also always asking myself, is my money all over the place? Do I need to stick with a few things? Could I maximize my money? So what are your thoughts on that, Linda? How can Miles maximize his money? Just from like his first thing here, it does seem like he's got his money all over the place, and that maybe a little consolidation would be in order. So So what do you think, Linda?
Well, first of all, these 401ks that he has from previous employers, he can roll those over into IRAs. And the advantage of doing that is he'll open up the investment options that he has to invest in, because 401ks generally have very limited investment option menus. And so under an IRA, he'll have, you know, more ETFs to choose from, and other sector funds and international funds and all kinds of things at his disposal, as well as individual stocks. But it sounds like because he's a beginning investor, he'll want to stick with a very general asset allocation model, which would, as I always say, include large cap, mid cap, small caps, some international and some other sector funds peppered in there, maybe some REITs, et cetera. He wants to have a general asset allocation model that he follows, and I think consolidate those 401ks into an IRA that'll also cut down on some fees, hopefully, that he's paying, and get rid of those. And it'll give him more control over his money. And then from being not really knowledgeable, I think, you know, learning about ETFs and learning about investing, but using an asset allocation structure and model is going to keep him out of a lot of trouble. I'd tell him to stay away from individual stocks right now, since he's not knowledgeable about those, and you can get yourself into a lot of trouble quickly by investing too much in individual stocks. So I'd stay with an asset allocation with ETFs, low cost ETFs.
Okay, great. Thanks, Linda. What about you, Joe? So one of the things is, I mean, he is still contributing to one of his 401ks. So I like the idea of taking the old 401k from the old employer and rolling it into an IRA, and then maybe talking to a tax person about, well, does he want to put it into his Roth? Like, does he want to move those assets there, is the next question, I guess. But what do you think, Joe? Does he need to do a little more consolidation? What do you think?
Well, I think if we do what Stephen Covey says and begin with the end in mind, I totally agree with everything that Linda said. But I think that this feeling that I get from Miles' note that he's a little bit all over the place is because he's not really looking at the end goal. And what's cool is people get freaked out by investments, right? He says he's doing what's comfortable for him. And we get freaked out because of the fact that there's so many different things out there. There's so much to know. Like, what should I know? What is irrelevant? And it's much easier if you start with, where do I want to go? And then historically, which investments have been the best vehicle to get me there. And what that does is takes this huge range of choices and makes it a much narrower range of choices. And then you only have to learn about those. So as an example, the two asset classes that over longer periods of time that have beaten inflation regularly and fairly consistently are real estate and the stock market. So instead of learning about 15 different savings accounts, let's say it's for a 15-year goal, learning about how stock market asset allocation works, learning about different asset classes of stocks and real estate is fantastic. And then if he focuses on just a few of those that historically have done best, like the total stock market index or been safest, safest pick.
Oh, I don't know about safest either, buddy.
but I'm talking about in terms of wide diversification, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And, you know, using a REIT versus buying an individual piece of property if you don't want to get into property management. Like you can pull that back further and say, you know what? I don't even have to focus on all the stocks that are out there, all the stock choices that are out there, all the real estate choices. I can focus on just a few. I would start with the end in mind and work backwards. And I think it's going to make his job easier.
Yeah, I like that idea. Too often we just start putting stuff in there. We're like, well, I know I should be doing this, but why are you doing it, and what is the end goal? So that's a really good point.
Yeah, and that was always the phrase that frustrated me, or the answer that frustrated me. I would look at somebody's portfolio and I'd say, so where do you hope to end up with this? And they would get this look in their eye like, I've never thought about that before.
Yeah, and that's I have
no idea where this is going to get me.
That's really where you need to start.
Can I just add one more thing?
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about Miles's bank interest-bearing checking account and how he's using that as a vehicle for wealth building, because it's got to be only yielding around 2% right now, which means it's going to take 36 years to double his money. I get the idea, too, that he's a younger person. He has a lot of time to compound his money. I think it's really important that he get it in something that can compound at a higher rate than an interest-bearing account at a 2 or 3% rate. Even if he's getting 3%, some of these online banks give you close to 3%. So I think rather than that, he needs to get into the stock market, get into something that can compound his money at a higher rate so that he can reach those levels and will be able to have that retirement goal in mind like Joe was talking about.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right. So let's move on to our next question. It is from Christian. Christian says, I love you guys show. Thank you, Christian. We love you too. And he's trying to capture all our tips. He recently graduated from college and he's got some student loan debt that he'll have to start paying off. He is trying to refinance, however. I have hopes for my first home within 6 months to a year. He has moved back home with his parents. He started an awesome full-time job with great benefits. And he's listened to a few podcasts that he can put his money away so that when he's ready to get his new place, he's on there. So he's saving in a lot of places. And he wanted to ask, what is the best way to start saving for a home purchase? And where should I put the money? So he wants to know, should I put this money as I'm saving up for my home purchase? Do I put it just in an interest-bearing saving account? Or should I go another route, leave that money alone? Or how does he manage the student loans payments and mortgage payments wisely when he does decide to move out in about 1 year? So this is actually really cool that you're planning ahead and you're thinking about it and you do want to move out. And, you know, as you do start saving for a home, I mean, what do you guys think? I mean, let's start with you this time, Joe. Where should Christian start about saving for a home?
Well, it's funny because going back to Miles, if we start with the time frame and work backwards, he's looking at a year from now. When we look at a year from now, those two assets I talked about before, asset classes, real estate and stocks, saving into those places would be absolutely horrible. Real estate is too expensive to get in and out. And with the stock market, it's way too volatile. So with a one-year goal, we do want to look at some of the places where actually Miles has his money, which are those high interest savings accounts, because we know the money will be there. It's going to be kept safe. And he can be assured that he's not going to lose money off of his down payment. When it comes to the budget part of his question, here's what I'd do. I would look at the total cost of his house. So not just the mortgage, but also the property taxes and his homeowner's insurance. So the escrow payment on top of that, and maybe even utilities. And I might try to save that money on a monthly basis automatically so he can feel for himself if he really can afford that payment every month or not. And there's no downside, right? If he can't afford it at this point, he learns his lesson, won't lose a house because he was just saving it automatically into a savings account somewhere. And he can kind of train himself to get used to that mortgage payment before he bites it off.
Yeah, I really like the test drive idea of the mortgage payment and figuring out where you stand with that. What about you, Linda? What are your thoughts on where to save and how to save up for this home?
Well, first, I want to say that Miranda is the college loan expert in our group. And so after I'm done, I'm going to refer it back to you to talk about the student loan situation. But you know, here's the thing. You're going to be applying for new debt, Christian, and you already have debt. And so that is going to be taken into account by the bank in terms of what you can afford as your payment and what your credit is and that kind of thing. So right now, if you're planning to buy a new house, you really need to up your credit score, get that improved as much as possible. And you need to reduce your debt as much as possible. Whatever that interest rate is on your debt, if it's more than what you're earning in your savings account, then it makes more sense to pay down the debt. So if you're earning 2% in your savings account and your student loan debt is at 5%, it makes more sense to me to pay off the 5% debt because it's like earning 5% when you're paying it down. So it's a good idea to get rid of that debt, focus on your credit score, and then once you do qualify for a home, and assuming you can buy a home, which by the way, I think I agree with Joe, just save the money in the bank account. Don't take any risk with that money. Just leave it in the bank account and use that for your down payment. Once you qualify for the home and purchase it, then make a 1/12th extra payment per month. And so like, let's say your payment was $1,200 a month, a 1/12th of that would be $100. If you paid $100 extra on every month, it would be like making one extra premium per year on your mortgage, and that helps pay your mortgage down sooner. So always pay a little bit extra than your mortgage payment, and that will go right toward your principal and help you pay off your mortgage more quickly.
Yeah, so I am going to disagree with Linda just slightly about the student debt issue, because one of the issues you run into with the student loan debt, I don't know how much you have, but when you have such a large amount of it, trying to, and it is, it's no matter what debt you have, it's going to be higher than your savings account interest rate. I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, as far as your student loan debt goes, if you are successful refinancing it, remember, if you do refinance your debt, if you have federal loans and you are financing those, then you lose access to protections that come with federal loans. So make sure you think about that carefully before you take that step to refinance. Refinancing can be great. It can lower your payments. It can lower your interest rate. You can refinance to a shorter loan term so you get out of that debt faster. Definitely something to think about. But also remember, when you refinance, you do lose your federal protections on your federal loans. So you really need to weigh that out and think about down the road, am I going to want, you know, what happens if I need access to better deferment options? What happens if something happens to my sweet job and I end up needing something like income-driven repayment? So think about that before you refinance. But once you've decided that you want to refinance and you think it's the best thing for you, you know, look at it too in terms of, you know, monthly cash flow. One of the things that they'll look at when they're looking at your debt and your mortgage and your student loan debt is they'll look at your monthly payment and figure out, can you handle the student loan debt and the mortgage debt? And I would say if the only types of debt you have are student loan debt and then soon to be mortgage debt, paying them both at the same time works as long as you have the budget for it. So as long as that monthly cash flow is in line and you have the budget for it, yes, you want to pay down that student loan debt as quickly as possible. But if you have the cash flow to manage both payments, I don't think you need to wait to buy a home if that home is what you really want to buy. So keep that in mind. If you have other debts like a car loan or credit cards or something like that, then that stuff definitely you want to like knock out and get rid of before you move forward with the home purchase. But, you know, managing both student loans and a home purchase is very manageable. I did it myself for 7 years when I owned a home and it was not a problem. And yeah, it just depends on what you're comfortable with. So think about that. Any other thoughts before we move on to our next listener question?
No, actually, I don't, but I thought this might be a good time for us to take just a quick break.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Let's tell everybody that if you've ever wondered if there were a way to capitalize on all the online chatter, the millions of investors on social media, your wait's over because the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated money managers, it's now at your fingertips and you can make their edge your edge. It's called the Buzz Index. It's licensed to an exchange traded fund, trades under ticker symbol BUZ, and provides investors with a portfolio of securities which show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. They don't use surveys. They don't guess. Instead, Buzz targets the most mentioned large cap U.S. stocks across the social media landscape. The more active the conversation, the greater the reliability of the buzz. Each of the most mentioned stocks is then given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics. And the 75 stocks that have the most bullish scores, well, those get included in the index each month. They track the index to capture the latest big data driven insights, and 75 companies each month then get selected, again, positioning Buzz to capture always the highest return potential. Invest in the wisdom of crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. I love, by the way, the Buzz Index newsletter. So if you want to just kick the tire, sign up for the newsletter because you'll get something from Jamie Wise and company over at Buzz to find out a lot about how it works and what they do and really interesting analytics over there. I also have to disclose that my spouse and I use the Buzz Index in our portfolio. It doesn't make it right for you, but should probably tell you that too. All right, Miranda, back to you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Joe. So our next question comes from Chevron. And Chevron says, love your podcast. Awesome tips. I have been told by a mentor of mine to keep a small percentage of my income as liquid cash and to put the remaining portion of my income into investments. How do you guys feel about that? Is there a percentage or ratio of a person's income that they should keep liquid versus how much of their income they should invest? If this is a good tip, is there a good investment platform that most of the money you put aside for investments should be in? For example, if I take 80% of my income and invest it each month or year, what portion of that 80% should I invest in high return investments? And what are those high return investments? Thanks, guys. All right, Linda, let's shove it over to you. Let's talk about liquidity and investments and everything else. Let's do the thing.
Okay. Well, Chevron has lots of good questions. I think that it is important to have an emergency fund. That's what he or she's talking about with liquid cash. And I think that it depends. There's no one right answer in terms of how much you should have for an emergency fund. But I would say, you know, if you have rent or a mortgage, you know, think about having the ability to make a couple of payments with that. If you own a car, if your car had repair that it needed or needed to pay a deductible, or you had medical expenses needed to pay your deductible, think about those kinds of things, which would be unforeseen events that you would want an emergency fund for. So I would keep some liquidity, a few thousand dollars, usually $2,000 to $3,000 might be something a lot of people talk about as their emergency fund. From that, I agree that you should put something into, I wouldn't call it high return investments, or I would just say something that can compound at a higher rate, which would be typically a stock market type investment, whether that's an all market fund, like Joe talked about earlier, which is very well diversified. If you're just going to pick one thing, that would be very broadly diversified. Or if you have a larger portfolio to invest, then getting involved in a total asset allocation program of, you know, large cap growth, large cap value, mid caps, small caps, international, et cetera, and maybe some short-term bonds, I think would be the right way to go to get your money invested.
Okay, great thoughts. And what about you, Joe? What do you think about this situation?
You know, I love the idea that Chevron is talking to their mentor, and the mentor is leading them in the right direction. So fantastic there. Great advice from the mentor. You know, for me, the cash reserve, I like looking at your employment situation and thinking to myself, what's the chance my job's going to go away? And be pretty realistic. You know, if there's a fairly good chance that your job will go away, then maybe look at 9 to 12 months of expenses. If you have a very, very solid job, then, you know, the rule of thumb people say is 3 to 6 months of expenses. And by the way, a lot of people, they look at the amount of money they bring in and they think that that's the amount you have to multiply that amount. It's not that. It's expenses, not income. So make sure, which is a much lower number for many of our listeners, especially if you're pretty frugal, that, you know, it doesn't have to be a ton of money that's there. In terms of investments, I'm going to sound, Miranda, like a broken record. Start with the end in mind. What are you trying to achieve? And then go with investment platforms that help you achieve that goal. And I think that's the way to start.
Yeah, I think that's a really great idea. And, you know, it's always good to have some of that liquidity happening.
I do have one more piece of advice.
Oh, do it.
A lot of people, Chevron, look at the perfect investment, which a lot of your question is about, what's the perfect investment for me? And I'll tell you, there have been a lot of studies shown that people spend way more time thinking about the perfect investment than they do the right tax platform. And the right tax platform can really save you a lot of money. So if you're eligible to put the money in your 401k, put it there. Or if you can get a tax break by putting in a traditional IRA, or if you want it a little more flexible, or if you're younger and you're looking aggressively growing it, but you don't want the tax break today, you want it tomorrow, a Roth IRA. So first, I think I'd study, what tax shelter can I get on my investment, or do I need to keep this money liquid? And then I would look for the right investment.
Okay, makes a lot of sense. All right. We have a question all the way from Germany. So we've got this question from Jan, and he says, I am 36 years old from Germany, and he likes our show very much. He says, investment in equity is not very common in Germany compared to the US. However, during the last few years, passive long-term investment in ETFs has become more and more popular. So he's talking about, to keep things simple, many experts are offering models that, you know, like a 3 ETF strategy, and you split the savings through Europe, the USA, and emerging markets with a fixed percentage. So he's concerned because he thinks these models are imbalanced. And he talks about an episode where Doug Goldstein pointed out that some of the popular ETFs concentrate in investments into a few major companies only. So he's a little concerned about the information. He can analyze his current portfolio, which has 16 different ETF positions. And so he's worried about sector rates, regional distribution, and cap size. So instead of automatic investment in all ETFs, he would rather choose one or two ETFs for active investment. So my portfolio is rebalanced in order to match my desired composition of sector weighting, regional distribution, and cap size. So on the downside, the cost averaging is not always possible because he doesn't invest in all the positions of the portfolio regularly, and so has higher transaction fees. So how do we look at this? He asks, is it beneficial to neglect cost averaging effects by investing irregularly for a higher balance regarding sectors, regions, and cap size? Or is a 16-position ETF portfolio just a very elegant way of spending my free time and paying transaction fees? So what do you think, Linda? I have no idea what to do with this. I'm just like, I think an S&P 500 ETF is great because it's everything. And I just throw my money at it and move on. So what do you think, Linda?
Well, what's interesting is his international perspective. And I love that Jan is asking us from that perspective, because we always talk from a U.S. perspective. And oftentimes the best returns are not in the U.S. They're in some other country. And so I think that it's phenomenal that he is very broad in where he's investing, in emerging markets, in Europe, and in the US. I think that 16 ETFs to me seems a little bit too many. I would see if there's overlap among some of the ETFs that he might have. For example, a Europe ETF and what we would call an international ETF, but something that invests abroad would probably have some overlap. I would just make sure that he doesn't have too much overlap with all of those different portfolios, and just maybe narrow it down to about 10. Because in an asset allocation model, you can have a nice portfolio with about 10 different ETFs. I don't think that's too many. It's still a lot, but it's, you know, not 16. And that will hopefully help reduce some fees, although the fees are generally associated with what company is providing the ETF. So here in the US, there are certain companies that have lower fees than anyone else, and they tend to get most of the market share. So I would look at, if he's concerned about fees, I would look at what company he is buying his ETFs from and try not to have too much overlap with his portfolios. But I think overall, it sounds like he's doing a great job and he's learned a lot about investing. So good job, Jan.
Okay, cool. And what do you think, Joe? What are your thoughts on this situation?
I think that $10 in fees is not egregious. So I'm frankly not that worried about a $10 fee. I think a lot of people spend a lot of time worrying about a $10 fee, and that's the least of my worries. I also think that dollar cost averaging is nice, but Jan, that dollar cost averaging is less effective than putting as much away as quickly as possible up front. So I understand you only have so much money to invest, but historically, the quicker you put money in the market, 70% of the time, the stock markets go up. And if we actually are looking at making money, putting more in early is the better way to go. So I'm not sure exactly what I can add on top of what Linda said, but I'd also consider those two things.
Okay, great. I think that you both had some great thoughts and I'm good. So we'll move on to Simone. She says, thanks for lively discussions. I continue to learn. I'd welcome any advice that would also help other high income listeners. Please discuss the benefits of a non-deductible IRA versus a brokerage account with low cost index funds. Okay, so she's reached her contribution limits for both her 457 and her 401k this year. They're hoping to save $50,000 a year for retirement and cannot figure out how to invest the remaining $14,000. Not eligible for HSA because I'm covered by my husband's traditional health insurance plan. Our mortgage interest rate is 3.25%, so we're not inclined to prepay. Yeah. And we have a six-month emergency fund, are not inclined to be landlords. These are good problems to have, I realize, so thank you. So what do you think about that? I mean, if they want to put that $14,000 somewhere, where should they stick it? In a non-deductible IRA? You know, how can they boost the tax advantage savings in this sort of situation? I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, perhaps there's a situation where they can start a business and maybe use a SEP IRA or a simple IRA or something like that. What do you think, Joe?
I think that I don't know why I'd use a non-deductible IRA. I'd start off with a non-deductible IRA, Simone, but then I would, and these have to be two separate transactions, I would then do a Roth IRA conversion with that money, right? So don't leave the money in a non-deductible IRA. There's really very little advantage to that unless you do part two, which is do the Roth conversion. New rule this year that's different than in the past, we used to be able to convert money to a Roth IRA from a non-deductible IRA. And then if the market went down, we could take it back and then do it again. It's called a recharacterization. We could take it back. We could do it again and pay less tax. Can't do that anymore. So knowing what I mentioned earlier, that the market goes up 70% of the time, we want to do the Roth conversion, do it as early in the year as possible, and then make sure you have the money set aside for any tax you might have that might be owed. But if you do them fairly close to each other, that should be very little in the tax department.
Okay, really good point. And what about you, Linda? What do you think a good setup would be?
Well, first I want to say, Simone, great job. I love it when people are good savers and you are a strong saver. So that puts you in a powerful position because now you can choose what you want to do with your money instead of being behind the eight ball trying to pay off debt or other things. So, you know, you have a good low mortgage interest rate. That's phenomenal. You have contributed the maximums to your 457 and your 401k. That's awesome. Now you're asking, what can you do further to further improve your financial situation? And I would say that you want to focus on your compounding. You want to focus on where are you placing your money that's going to grow for you. And it sounds like you don't want more real estate. You are inclined to be in the stock market. And I would just say, make sure that you're diversified. Make sure that you have enough asset classes in what you're investing in so that you're not all 100%, for example, in the S&P 500. You should be, you know, having all the asset classes that I've talked about. And I would just say, you know, continue to diversify, continue to invest, because getting that money from low compounding to high compounding interest rates or high compounding rates, rather, is what's going to build wealth for you. So get it into things that are going to compound. And that's the key. And it sounds like you're doing a great job at that. So congratulations.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today for this listener questions episode. Thank you to all the listeners who send in their questions. We're always happy to answer them, and we hope that it's useful to you. We will have another listener question episode in a couple more weeks. We have plenty of listener questions to fill the time. So hopefully we'll get back into that as this new year gets underway. Speaking of the new year getting underway, what is going on with you, Linda? What have you got going on for this new year?
Well, at Be Wealthy and Smart, I recently did a podcast about the one thing you need to do to have success in 2018. So I know there's lots of good ideas out there, but I give you just one thing to focus on, that if you could only do one thing, this would be it. And you can find that at lyndapjones.com or Be Wealthy and Smart on iTunes and Stitcher Radio.
Awesome. And what about you, Joe? What have you got going on in this brand new year?
I have a brand new podcast, woohoo, called Money in the Morning. It starts off as a Facebook Live. And if you're part of our Facebook community, you can stop and say hi there. We don't tape at a set time, or record rather at a set time. When I say tape, it makes me sound like I'm 140 years old, doesn't it?
It does. You're ancient.
Yeah, we put it on the cassette tape, the reel-to-reel tape, the Betamax.
And the 8-track.
And I sit here in my Jordache jeans. And wait, there are people young enough to not even get that joke. But anyway, it's called Money in the Morning. It's available where you listen to the Money Tree podcast. It's a very short podcast. We do two financial headlines per day. Always something new going on in the world of personal finance. And so we just address those. So Money in the Morning, our brand new show.
Great. Thank you so much. And I'm actually doing a little Facebook Live myself. Speaking of Facebook Live, every Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. Eastern over for Adulting, if you head on over to the Adulting Facebook page, or if you join our Adulting community on Facebook, I am doing an Adulting Help series. Today's episode, which will be done and over with by the time this Money Tree podcast episode airs, I'm doing it on emergency funds and how I use a two-tiered emergency fund, answering a question from one of our Adulting listeners. So head on over to the Adulting Facebook page every Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. Eastern, and you can check out that Facebook Live. And don't forget to check out the moneytreepodcast.com. So moneytreepodcast.com, that's where you can get access to all of our past episodes, get a few resources, and find out what else we are up to as panelists, and do a little catching up with what's going on. You can also use that website to send us your own listener questions, and we might get to them in a future episode and answer your question and help other folks with it. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and, you know, do all those things, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play. So however you want to do it, we will be delivered to your device every Friday morning. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.